Dolores Huerta. She's an American labor leader and civil rights activist. She's also the co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union, and last week she spoke at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of University of Utah. Among many of the various things Huerta discussed, she talks about the parts of American history that aren't generally taught in American schools.
And so we have the Mexicans that came in and, they tilled the fields, they built the railroads along with the Japanese and the Chinese and the Filipinos and the people from India. All of these people of color that came here to build our country. Now, if we are not taught this in our elementary schools, our children of color will never get the respect, that they deserve for what their people did. They will always feel and be treated like second-class citizens.
Coming up on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, a talk by longtime civil rights activist and labor leader Dolores Huerta. That's coming up just ahead, but first we'll get our summary of the latest world news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, a talk given by longtime civil rights activist, American labor leader, feminist, and mother Dolores Huerta. She's a founder of the Agricultural Workers Association and co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union. Huerta has spent her life working to fight against discrimination and to improve conditions for farm workers, many of them immigrant laborers. In 2012, Huerta received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Last week, Dolores Huerta was in Utah for the screening of a documentary about her life. While she was here, she spoke to University of Utah students, and her discussion covered everything from immigration in the Trump era to the state of labor unions today, to income inequality, and beyond. Here's Dolores Huerta, speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Her talk was recorded on March 14th.
So we have so many things to talk about. I hardly know where to begin. And I'm glad that you mentioned, Mr. Williams mentioned the fact that you're having this whole dedication and focus on immigration and refugees. And I know that that's been one of the really hot topics that we have had in our national conversation right now. But it's something that we talk about, but sometimes I think we just don't know a lot about immigration. And the reason I say this is because recently there has been, as you know, a lot of deportations that have been taking place throughout the country. California has been especially hit very hard because the state of California declared that we were going to be a sanctuary state. What does that mean? A sanctuary state means basically that when an undocumented person is arrested and they have some kind of a violation, a traffic violation, or some kind of a misdemeanor, that when they finish their term, that they're allowed to go home. And what was happening before is that they would call in the ICE agents, immigration agents, and turn them over to immigration. Well, in California now, they can't do that anymore. What they have to do, if a person has a really violent felony of some sort, of narcotics or some type of, where they have actually had a victim that has been injured, then they can turn them over and should turn them over to the ICE agent for deportation. But if they haven't really done anything that harms anybody, then they're supposed to let them, just go home without deporting them. And so that has been a very big issue. And of course, the Trump administration kind of doubled down on that and sent more ICE agents into California. And they've just had a whole series of raids, and they have deported a whole bunch of people in California. When we think about, and we think of how many people have come to the United States, and I just like to remind people in the first place that this was a country of immigrants to begin with, right? So unless you're Native American, your people came from somewhere. And this was a brown country when people from Europe, arrived at the United States. It was a brown country. And it's really sad that we don't really teach more of that in our school systems. Because we can think of the one issue that I believe is a great cancer in our society that is harming not only the United States, but also throughout the world, because we are the most powerful country in the world, is the whole issue of racism. And so much of the racism has been focused on immigrants and immigrants of color. And when we look back and we think, okay, why does this happen? And I do believe that one of the issues that we have right now is we do have what I call abysmal ignorance in the United States of America. Because in our school books, starting with the elementary schools, we do not teach the real history of the United States of America, the Howard Zinn history of the United States of America. Howard Zinn, by the way, is a great writer, teacher, and you should get his book, The Real History of the United States of America. But for instance, in our school books, we never really referred to the genocide that we had of Native Americans in our country. When we think of the Native Americans were the first slaves. Have we ever thanked Native Americans or said thank you for taking their land? Have we ever compensated them for taking their land? No, we haven't. And yet we know that many of our Indian reservations, we have very high poverty rates, suicide rates, you know, lack of proper education in many of our reservations in the United States. And that would seem that would be a very simple thing to take care of in our country, right? Very simple thing. So Native Americans were the first slaves. And then what about the White House and the Congress were built by African slaves? Are we taught that? No, we're not taught that. And all of these great buildings that we have in Washington, D.C., were built by African slaves. We think of Montebello, where Jefferson lived, you know. The Capitol in Richmond, Virginia, built by African slaves. So then, of course, we have all of the immigrants that came here from Mexico. Mexicans are good, by the way. Everybody. And when they tell us Latinos to go back where we came from, we need to say we are where we came from because we are the indigenous people of the continent, okay? And we didn't cross the border crossed us. Yeah. We were here before the border, okay? Anyway, and so we have the Mexicans that came in and, you know, they tilled the fields, they built the railroads along with the Japanese and the Chinese and the Filipinos and the people from India, all of these people of color that came here to build our country. Now, if we are not taught this in our elementary schools, our children of color will never get the respect, you know, that they deserve for what their people did. They will always feel and be treated like second-class citizens. And our Anglo children, our Caucasian children, will always have that poison of white supremacy and white privilege, which is a poison in their minds that they feel that. So, you know, we've really got to, you know, in order to deal with all of this, we have got to change the content of our educational system. In order to combat the racism and the misogyny, you know, the sexism against women, the homophobia, you know, these whole attitudes about hating people because they happen to be gay, lesbian, and transgender, you know, labor studies, all of this has got to be included in our educational system so that our people can really have a quality education and the bigotry looking down on people because they're poor. Or because they're working people. Just think about this, about labor studies, for instance. How did we get the 8-hour day?
Union.
Thank you. How did we get Social Security?
Union.
How did we get safety standards?
Union.
How did we get unemployment insurance?
Union.
Right? How did we get public education?
Union.
And yet we have this big pressure going on right now where they are trying to get rid of labor unions. Now, if we get rid of labor unions, basically what we do is we get rid of the middle class in our society because organized labor, they are the ones that actually raise the wages of workers and raise the benefits of workers. And yet we have right now in the Supreme Court, they are considering right now a law that would take away the right of workers to deduct dues from workers' paychecks. Now, many of our states here, and I imagine this one is a right-to-work state also, right? What does that mean? Right to work means right to work for lower wages and lower benefits. When you think of the employers, they have a lot of organizations they belong to. They have the Manufacturers Association, they have the Chamber of Commerce. If you're a grower, you belong to the Western Growers, the Associated Farmers, on and on. So the employers, all of them, the bosses, they have a lot of organizations that they belong to. And they pay fees and they pay dues to those organizations. Workers only have one organization, and that is their union. That's the only organization that they have that can represent them at the workplace, that can represent them at the state capitol, that can represent them in the Congress. And yet, these very big, wealthy billionaires like the Koch brothers, if you haven't heard of them, please Google them, okay? K-O-C-H, the Koch brothers. These men are very, very rich. They've gotten rich off of oil. They've gotten rich by breaking the law. People have died in some of their enterprises, but you know they have all of this money, and they're trying to crush and get rid of labor unions, get rid of workers' organizations, okay? That's what they're trying to do. So again, if labor unions create the middle class in our society, and if we don't have a middle class, then guess what? We don't have a democracy. We don't have a democracy in the United States of America. So right now, in the United States, we have, 1% of the wealthy families in the United States, they own 50% of the wealth. 50% of the wealth. Families like the Waltons that own Walmart. By the way, friends don't let their friends shop at Walmart, okay? Because they pay their workers minimum wage, they don't give them enough hours so that they can get health benefits. I mean, it's just very greedy wealth. So you have 1% of the families that own 50% of the wealth, okay? Then you have 10% of the corporations and families that own 90% of the wealth of the United States of America. Now, we know a lot of people are just trying to get an increased minimum wage to $15 an hour, right? Families have to work two jobs to put food on the table. Families are having a hard time making ends meet. We have an explosion of homeless people because they can't pay rents anymore. How could this be in the richest country in the world? At the same time, you have some of these chief executive officers of these giant corporations. What is their salary? Well, maybe $16 million a year. $16 million a year. $30 million a year. When the Wells Fargo president stepped down after, you know, cheating and robbing all of the people that have their assets in Wells Fargo, I think he had like $37 million plus the stock options that he had. So this is wrong. This is an obscenity. At the same time, in the last presidential election, there was a lot of talk about, yes, we should have free tuition for all college students, right? Should we? We talk about we should have free health care for everybody. Now, this is not just a pipe dream. This is possible. Because other countries that are not rich, like the United States of America, this is what they have. Countries in Europe, they have free health care. They have free education for all of their citizens. There's a little country down in Latin America called Cuba. Cuba is a small little country which has an economic boycott on Cuba by the United States of America. But every single person in Cuba has free college education. You can become a doctor in Cuba, even from here from the United States, go to Cuba, and you can become a doctor free, you know? And so free education, free healthcare for everyone. So if they can do it, why can't we do it? We need to be able to do that for all of our citizens. And of course, one of the reasons that we can't do that is, number one, the wealth is up here with all of these wealthy, greedy people. But there's one other reason. Guess what? Well, let me explain to you this way. I was reading the New York Times once in the business section, which, by the way, I call a crime report. Okay. And there was an article a few years ago about a little country called Norway. You know, the ones that got all the medals, you know, in the Olympics. Well, Norway, it turns out that in that article that they have a $400 billion surplus. I thought, how did this little teeny country get a $400 billion surplus? You know how? They own their oil. They own their oil. We in the United States, we do not own our natural resources. We do not own our oil. We do not own our utility systems, our telephone systems, our transportation systems. Corporations own our oil. So every time we go to the gas and to fill up our cars with gasoline, that money doesn't go to us. It goes to these corporations, okay? There's something wrong with that picture. There's something wrong with that picture. And if some other countries don't want to follow our example, I'm going to call it greedy capitalism, then you know what? We kind of make them our enemies. You know? So when we think of all of these things that we need to fix in our United States of America, we figure, how can we do that? How can we fix it? Well, actually, there's only one way, and that is by voting. A really simple way. A really simple way. And the way that we do that is by electing progressive people that care about their constituents to political office. But unfortunately, we know that a lot of our people don't vote. A lot of people think it's a waste of time. And I don't know, you've been following the elections that have been happening recently. Just said last night, you know, I was awake till about 2 o'clock in the morning following this election that was happening in Pennsylvania. And it looks like the Democrat may have won, but it was very, very close. In the state of Virginia, there were 17 delegates that got elected to the House in Virginia, and the 17th delegate lost by one vote, one single vote. So we've really got to get out there, and we've got to make sure that every single person votes and that they understand the importance of voting. Because the only way that we can start changing some of these wrongs that we have in our country is by taking the power.
That's Dolores Huerta, longtime civil rights activist and American labor leader. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. And today, we're airing a talk given last week by Dolores Huerta. She's an American labor leader, civil rights activist, and co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union.
With my foundation, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, we do grassroots organizing. And we go into communities of very poor people and working people, and we organize them in their homes. And you'll see part of that in the movie tonight. But so we meet with a few people. I'm going to use the word Tupperware. Does that strike a bell with anybody? Okay. Yeah, a few people in their homes, and then we talk about the issues, and then we talk about how we can solve the issues, and then we get people to commit that they will volunteer to solve the issues in their communities. So in one of these house meetings that we had, we call them house meetings, there was a woman named Leticia Prado. She is an immigrant from Mexico. She's now a citizen, speaks very broken English. But in that house meeting that we had with she and her husband, they decided that they wanted to, their middle school didn't have a gymnasium. So Leticia and her husband, Timoteo, they went out into their neighborhood and they passed a petition and they put a bond issue on the ballot. They went door to door, making sure people had enough signatures to put the bond issue on. Then they had the election. They passed the election with 70% of the vote. Now they have a brand new gymnasium, state-of-the-art gymnasium. And I'm going to say the word weed patch. Any of you that read The Grapes of Wrath or saw the movie Grapes of Wrath, that's where weed patch, that is the place where The Grapes of Wrath was filmed. And if you went there today, it looks pretty much like it did back then when they filmed The Grapes of Wrath, okay? So after they got that gymnasium, Letitia decided that she would run for the school board. And so she ran and she got herself elected. Well, the superintendent that they had just hired wanted to get rid of the breakfast program for the farm worker children. It was too much paperwork, he said. So Letitia, being on the school board, got rid of him and kept the breakfast program. So after that, she decided to run for another district, the Lamont Water District, and she ran for that school, that water district. And as soon as she got hired, she started vetting the new manager that they had hired there, found out that he had been fired for embezzlement from another district. And so she got rid of him, okay? And then she looked at the bank records and found out there was $250,000 missing from the bank. You know, some funds that somehow were unaccounted for. And so she called in the grand jury. But this is one woman, one farm worker woman, never went to high school, never went to college, but very intelligent. And you know, she got those positions and started acting and carrying out the duties of the positions that she got elected to. And that's really something important too. I mentioned the word bigotry earlier. When we look down on people that don't have a high school education or college education, or maybe because they don't speak perfect English, yeah. But you know, in Spanish, the word educado means that somebody is civil, you know, that they care about other people, that they're compassionate. It doesn't have anything to do with a formal education. In Mexico, the high schools are called preparatorias, to be prepared. So you get prepared for a career. And the reason I say this is because we should never look down on our parents or our grandparents or the people that work here at this university, the janitors, the people that work in food service, whatever, because they don't have a high school education. They may not have a high school education or college education, but they are muy preparados. They are very educated, okay? They are very educated. So I'm going to kind of roll back a little bit. Well, just let me say this. Coretta Scott King said this. She said, "We will never have peace in the world until women take power." Okay. But I am going to amend that. I'm going to say this, that we will never have peace in the world until feminists take power. Okay? Yeah, because we know that, what is a feminist? A feminist is somebody who cares about women's reproductive rights, number one, cares about LGBT rights, cares about workers' rights, cares about the environment, right? This is what a feminist is. Somebody cares about immigrants' rights also, I didn't mention that. So that is what a feminist is. So that means that all of the men in the room here can also be feminists, okay? So it's not just up to the women. But I do want to say to all of the women feminists in the room that sometimes we hold ourselves back. Like right now in the Congress, I think we're only about 20%. And when we talk about all of the countries in the world, we as women and feminists, we're like number 70 in the world when it comes to representation in our Congress and in government. I think it'll change after this election, 2018, because we see so many women that are not running for office. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because I think that one of the educational issues that we have to change is the way that we educate our women. Because from the time that we are little girls, we are taught somebody's going to protect you, somebody's going to support you, somebody's going to take care of you. And then we are taught what Walt Disney teaches us, that Prince Charming is going to come on a white horse, give you a big old kiss, and he's going to wake you up, and you're going to live happily ever after, right? And we know that sometimes just the opposite happens, that the prince, I call him as kind of a, not a substitute, but a false Prince Charming that will come, give you a kiss and put you to sleep, and then goes your career, and then baby's daddy's gone, you know? Donde se fue? Where'd he go? And then sometimes as a woman, you get traded in for a trophy wife, somebody that looks like you, like 20 years younger, something like that. So that we have to kind of change the way we raise our women. because I think our women have to be taught that they have to be good, they have to protect themselves, that they have to support themselves, and that they have to create their own support system. Because unfortunately in our society, women do not have a strong support system. The other thing, as women, we tend have a tendency to hold ourselves back. You know, we think somehow if we promote ourselves, that that's wrong, that we shouldn't be assertive. And we as women sometimes, we are, I'm not gonna say that we're afraid, but we're hesitant to take power. And we think, oh, maybe as a woman, I don't know how to handle power. Maybe only the guys know how to do that. But we have to realize that we as women are intellectually equal to men. And not only that, but we have something that men usually don't have, most men, and that's intuition. Because sometimes as women, we will know that we feel that something isn't quite right, and sometimes we can't articulate it, because we really can't find the words to define what we think is wrong. But, you know, we have to learn how to act on this and not to hold ourselves back, to let our voices be heard, because we have been, again, so socialized to be accommodating and to be supportive of men, right? And of others, that we are often not supportive enough of ourselves. And you know, when those opportunities arise, and we think, well, maybe I should try to go for that opportunity or that job, and then we think, well, I'm not really that qualified or I'm not that prepared. Just do it like the guys do it. Learn on the job, okay? And I'm going to give you a couple of examples in my own life. When we first started the Farm Workers Union, as you heard in the introduction, Cecil and I were together in this other organization, the Community Service Organization. We passed a whole bunch of laws. Some of them were mentioned here, that really helped people. But when it came time to form the union, we were having our convention, our first organizing constitutional convention, and Caesar was at the dais, and he steps down from the dais, and he comes up to me, and he says, who's going to nominate you? And I said, nominate me for what? To be an officer of the union. Okay, this is so typical of women, okay? Oh, Caesar, I don't have to be an officer. I just want to serve and help. Sound familiar? Yeah. And so he said, you're crazy. Get somebody to nominate you right now. And so, of course, I did, okay? So I became the vice president of the union. And tonight, when you see the movie, there's going to be a picture of when we signed the contracts for the farm workers. I had been on the strike, and then I went to the boycott. I organized a boycott on the East Coast, boycott of grapes. And then I came back to the West Coast because they still had grapes on the West Coast. And that was kind of a macho thing that I can explain. But I did on the East Coast, I got all of the smaller stores to take off the grapes. And then I got the middle chains to take off the grapes. And then we got the big chains to take off the grapes. So I started from the bottom and worked up. So we got all of the East Coast clean from Chicago to New York to Florida and up to Canada. Well, in California, they still had all the grapes in all the stores, because they had taken on the biggest chain, Safeway, okay? So I went back to California and I did the same strategy that I did in the East Coast, starting with the smaller chains, right? And that's the difference between the way women think and men think, right? And Caesar said, let's take on the biggest chain. I said, let's start with the smaller chains and work our way up, okay? So we got all of the grapes out of the stores, and then we were gonna sign the contracts. So, and by the way, then I did the negotiations with the growers. With all of the grape growers, I negotiated all the contracts, with all the growers came together, and so we ended this 5-year strike and boycott. Well, when it came time to take the pictures, I was sitting next to Caesar, and one of our vice presidents, Larry E. Leong, said to me, Doris, do you mind if I sit there? And I said, of course, Larry, sit down. And I walked away. And so when those pictures come out, when we are settling the 5-year strike and boycott and signing the contracts, I am not in the picture. Lesson, huh? That's a good lesson. So, you know, we as women, when we go to an event and we look at the dais and we see that there are no women on there, say, I'm sorry, but there aren't any women on that dais, so we gotta make sure we get some women up there, okay? So let's make that a habit and a practice, because I can assure you, And you know, when we turn on our television and we see all of these people, all of these men, at all of these meetings, and you know that they're making really important decisions, and I like to say, if there are not any women at the table, they are going to make the wrong decisions, okay? So, you know, we've got to make sure that we have good representation on all of these boards. And I'm going to start with school board. And I'm going to ask a question. How many of you know who your school board members are? Raise your hand. Okay, we have a few hands. How many of you know who your representative is to the state legislature? Raise your hands. That's a little bit better. Okay. How many of you know who your state senators are? That's even better. Okay. And I'm sure you all know who your U.S. senator is, right? Your federal senators? Not too bad. So if we wanted to be able to change the content again of what we teach in our schools, we've got to make sure we get good people on our school boards, right? Yeah. We've got to make sure we get good people on our school boards. And my own foundation right now, we have been trying to stop the school-to-prison pipeline because we have so many of our children of color. They're not dropping out. They're being pushed out. They're being pushed out. And we just sued our local high school district in Bakersfield, California, 37,000 high school students. They suspended over 2,000 and expelled over 2,000 kids in a one-year period, most of them African-American and Latinos, okay? And so we sued them, we settled the lawsuit, now they have to change their whole behavior system. They have to have a cultural competency training for the teachers. They gotta have positive behavior intervention systems, restorative justice. To stop the racism, they've got to have one whole month of African American Heritage Month, Latino Heritage Month for another month. They've got to change the way that they do the recruitment of their teachers. We have 22 high schools, zero principal Latinos. 22 high schools, zero African American principals, okay? The racism is entrenched. And not only that, but recently, because we were going to sue them on the way that they elect the people to the school district, because they gerrymandered all of the lines so that all of the school board members, all men, by the way, all live within 5 miles of each other. Just last week, they've announced they're gonna draw new lines after they met with our attorneys, okay? So then we sued our board of supervisors for the same reason, because they redistricted the lines so we couldn't have any Latino representation, and we just won that lawsuit also. So this is the work that we're doing. And by the way, this is happening all over the country. And when kids get in trouble, what do? They call the police. So immediately that child gets some kind of a criminal record. And we have got to stop this. You know, we know that they don't have enough jobs for people. By the way, I'm really upset because I just went to the McDonald's for breakfast. And guess what? They had kiosks there to order your meals from. How many people did they get rid of when they ordered the kiosks, you know? Again, when we don't have jobs for our young people, and they're eliminating more and more jobs. So, you know, we've got to, this is a big issue, I think, in our society right now. Are they putting people in prison just because they don't have jobs for them? We have more people in prison, I'm sure most of you know this, we have more people in prison in the United States of America than India or China. Their populations are billions of people. Our populations are, what, 300 million? And we have more people in prison than they do. So this is really, really wrong. So again, these are things we have to change. And kind of dialing back to the immigration issue, when people cross the border, it is not a criminal act. When they cross without papers, they're not hurting anybody. When they cross the border, it's a civil violation. It's not a criminal act, okay? They have made it a criminal act by deporting people. It never was like that before. People were deported. They would come back. They'd get deported. They'd come back, you know. But they didn't put them in prison. And they have built brand new prisons just for the people that are deported. So this is wrong. When we think about the number of people that we have in prison, when we think of so many behaviors then become criminal acts, then that means that we are becoming a fascist society. We are becoming a fascist society. And this is all, again, done by laws. Done by laws. And one other thing, too, when we talk, we never think, why do people come from Oaxaca? We go there as tourists, right? Or Guatemala. Or, you know, we go there to these beautiful countries. Why do people come to the United States of America? Because there aren't any opportunities for them. And we think, these are beautiful places. There should be opportunities for them. And I'm going to say the word bananas. How many bananas do we eat every day? Throughout the United States, we eat millions of bananas. Do the people in Guatemala get the money that we spend for bananas? Who gets the money? Dole. Chiquita Banana. The 50 banana companies. They get the money. The people in Guatemala do not get the money, you know? So we've got to change that mentality to think that somehow the world's resources belong to us. I remember during the war, we were trying to stop the war in Iraq, and somebody had a sign that said, how did our oil get under their sand? And instead of, you know, trying to take over other countries' economies, we should do like we did in World War II. When we defeated Japan and Germany in World War II, we had the Marshall Plan. And we sent jillions of U.S. tax dollars to Japan and Germany to help them rebuild their economies. So we have companies like Mitsubishi, who built the tanks, you know, that killed American soldiers in World War II, but we gave them the money to rebuild their economies. And Toyota, and all of these Japanese companies, and Volkswagen in Germany. But that was probably a good thing, right? Because we didn't take over their economies. We helped them develop their own economies. Well, we need to do the same thing with Latin America, and not just have economic colonization. Use our talents to really help these other countries develop their own economies. And then we will have a more peaceful world. We will have a more peaceful world. And one other thing, too, going back to the whole issue of racism. And it is really simple if we think of science, okay? If we think of science. We are one human race, just one. We don't have a lot of human races. We have one human race. And the name of our human race is? Louder? Homo sapiens, right? So we have different nationalities, different cultures, different ethnic or different ethnic groups and people, but we only have one human race, and we are Homo sapiens. Homo sapiens, that's our scientific name. And where did our human race begin? Somebody shout it out.
Africa.
So our human race began in Africa. So we began in Africa, we traveled across the planet, we went to Asia, people got lighter in skin, came down through the Bering Strait to the Americas. One of our tribes got lost, they went way up north where it's really cold, and they lost the color, right? Now they have to go to the tanning salon or to the beach to get the color back. So if we can think of that we are all Africans of different shades and colors. All of us. That means we are one human family. And we shouldn't think of somebody as lesser or better than us because they have a different color of skin. I mean, that is ridiculous when you think about it, okay? And so we can say to the KKK, to the neo-Nazis, to the alt-right, to all of those people who think that somehow white is supreme, just get over it, you're Africans, okay? Just get over it. So, as I said before, I think that the solution and the salvation of all of these issues that we have right now that we're facing in our country is education. Education, and we have the structure. We just have to change the content, right? We have to change the content so that we can have a more humane, a more compassionate world, and so that people will really respect and love each other. And think about, our goal should not be profits. Our goal should not be just profits. When you talk about guns, okay, big issue right now, guns. The whole issue about guns is what? Making money, profits, right? You know, like in our school district, like the number 45 is trying to do right now, saying all of the guns should have schools. I mean, all of the schools should have guns, you know? That is crazy. That's just you sell more guns, you make more money. So that shouldn't be our driving force in our United States of America. We should think more, going back to the indigenous people, that were here in the United States when many immigrants came here, we should think of sharing, of cooperation, of supporting each other, and not of domination, you know, or taking advantage of people, or trying to take money off of their bodies, like farm workers or people in prison, with this privatization of the prison system. We have to change our value system in the United States of America. And I think that we can do that, but it means that we all have to come together to make it happen. So we're going to have time for some questions. Just one, a couple more things. You know, when we think about some of us who fought so many years to get really good laws on the environment, for instance, one of the pesticides that our president removed from the restricted list, right after this happened, we had about 100 farm workers that were poisoned in California by that same pesticide that was taken off of the restricted list. So there's a lot of things that we have fought for and that have not been rolled back. And so we know that we're going to have to fight really, really hard to make sure that we can get them back. But I remember, and when you see the movie tonight, you're going to see something really great, is that the farm workers, who were the poorest people of all, were able to beat President Nixon, okay? And Ronald Reagan, the governor of California, who were very much against the Farm Workers Union. So I like to quote the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, who said this. He said, "You can cut all the flowers, but you can't hold back the spring. You can cut all the flowers, but you can't hold back the spring." So we have to think ourselves as being the gardeners out there that are going to be able to, you know, sow those seeds out there, you know, the seeds of justice, and those seeds will flower, and the spring will come back. But we are the ones that are going to have to do it. And so when I ask you to raise your hands, and I could also ask the question, I won't do it now, but how many of you voted? I'm sure a lot of you voted. But in addition to your voting, I'm just going to say for this next election, it's not enough to vote. Please go out there and join a campaign, you know, go join a campaign, join your party, whether it's Democrat or Republican or Green, whatever party it is. Get in there. These are democratic institutions. Let your voices be heard there so that we can really, all of us, become organizers for justice, all of us. We don't have to wait and say, let somebody else do it. When we were organizing the farm workers, people would say to us, how do you organize the farm workers? They're poor. They're not citizens. They don't speak English. They don't have any money. And what we said to the workers is this, you have power. You have power. You have power. Where is the power? The power is in your person. The power is in your person. And this is all the power that you need to make changes. But you can't do it by yourself. You've got to work with other people. You've got to take direct, nonviolent action. And this is the way that we make it happen. Direct, nonviolent action. And of course, I like to say that voting is the best nonviolent action that we can take. And we can march, and it's wonderful. We have the Women's March, we have Black Lives Matter, we have the Occupy, we have all of these protests and marches. But you know what? If we don't take it to the ballot box, it doesn't make any difference. Because the only way that you can change policies is by the people that we elect to office. Because they make the decisions. Are we going to have more money for schools, or are we going to have more money for jails, okay? They're the ones that make the decision. So I just hope that everybody here will make a commitment that they will go out there, walk a precinct, knock on a door, phone bank, call a voter, you know, get your neighbors, get everybody that you can to please participate in the election. It is a democracy, but if we do not participate in the democracy, then fascism will take our country over. It's up to us, okay? And so I'm going to ask all a question before we do the questions and answers. And the question I'm going to ask you is a really simple one. I'm going to ask you who's got the power, and I want you to say, we've got the power. And when I say, what kind of power, I want you to say people power, okay? But I want you to shout it very loud so that the neo-Nazis can hear us, all right? Okay, okay, I'll have to cut you first, okay? Who's got the power?
That's Dolores Huerta, civil rights activist, labor leader, feminist, and mother. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today, we are airing a talk given last week by Dolores Huerta, longtime civil rights activist and American labor leader. In this final segment, Dolores takes questions from the audience.
First of all, I saw your film at Sundance last year, so I echo your endorsement and hope that people will go see it tonight.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful film. And one of the things that I just wanted to say, which I thought was very powerful about it, was the vulnerability that you showed in having all your children participate and talking about the challenges that you experienced as an organizer in raising your family. And so I just want to thank you for that and to just ask you sort of what resources you would encourage all of us to find in terms of grassroots organizing our own communities so that we can be more effective.
Well, I believe that the way to start is to whatever issue that you're going to be working on, if there's not an organization already that you can volunteer with, is that you find somebody else to join with you in starting to work on that particular issue. Because sometimes we think that we have to have 100 people, but no, it's what we call the militant few. If you can get yourself, another friend, and then, like when we started the Farm Workers Union, it was just basically Cesar, his wife Helen Chavez, and myself. It's just the three of us. Then we got his brother, we got his cousin, and there was a cohort of us, you know, and then we kept growing and growing. But just start with just one or two people and you can make it happen, okay? And by the way, our website is DoloresHuerta.org for those of you that want to get more information about our organization. And we will be passing out some leaflets here at the end that talks about some of the other issues that we're working on. And also, if you want to join or to hear more about our organization, on your cell phone, just put joindhf.org, joindhf.org, okay? And we're trying to get our organizing model, which is very, very effective, that was really started by a man named Fred Ross Sr. He's the one that taught Cesar and myself and many others how to organize. And so I like to say that the Chicano movement, the godfather of the Chicano movement is an Anglo, a gringo, okay? Fred Ross Sr., okay? So we're trying to figure out how we can export that on the web so that people can learn our model.
Hi, thank you for being here today and for your resiliency and dapple you've been to young women like myself. My question is about machismo. During the time when you were grassroots organizing, how did you prevail against the machismo that was prevalent within organizers and continue? And what advice would you give us, young women, young men, anyone here today?
Well, I think that we have to address it. If you see the movie tonight, there's a whole section about that in my own work with the Farm Workers Union. And I had to kind of, because I was raised by my mother. My parents divorced when we were little children. So my mother was always the dominant force in our family. And so when I went to work in Delano, I realized that there was just a lot of machismo. And at first I didn't exactly know how to deal with it. I kind of had to kind of keep myself kind of silent on that because the work that we were doing was so important in terms of organizing the farm workers. But I did try to encourage other women to take leadership, although there were a lot of women on the picket lines and on the strikes and whatever. But getting the women to take leadership, I think, was the hardest part, because I would get them to run for the board, and then they would step down, or they wouldn't run. So it takes, I think it's got to be very deliberate, and that we have to address it. And sometimes we have to address it in a nice way, like a friend of ours makes a sexist remark or does something that puts women down. But then sometimes we have to do it openly. I call it instant education, right? So sometimes we have to embarrass people publicly. And the same thing comes with when somebody makes a homophobic remark or again, a racist remark. Sometimes you have to embarrass them publicly so that they will feel that emotional shock of you embarrassing them so that they won't do it again. But the main thing is that we should not stand up for it. And of course, with women, sometimes you have to organize it on the workplace. By the way, if you're the only woman that works in some job, tell them that you belong to the National Organization for Women, and the feminist majority, Just throw out all of these names of these organizations, okay? Latina leaders or whatever, because that way they know you're not alone in the workplace, all right? That you have a lot of women out there in the community that is supporting you. You know, I think that helps a little bit. But definitely we should not put up with machismo.
A question asked off mic by an audience member had to do with the takeaways from the documentary Dolores when it comes to the power of people who might otherwise be regarded as powerless, in particular, the poor.
Well, I think that's the biggest message that we hope comes out of the movie, is that you can see that the people that were the poorest people of all, the most denigrated people of all, that they were able to, well, once we organized them, okay, it didn't happen spontaneously. Before that strike happened in Delano, Cesar and I had house meetings with workers for 3 years. So when that strike happened, people were already ready to strike. And sometimes people think it was very spontaneous. It wasn't spontaneous. It was very well organized. And that's the one thing, too, when we think about these big movements, is that you have to have some kind of organization and structure if you want them to last for any period of time. Because if you don't, then it's kind of just, like in the Occupy movement is a good example. They brought the great messages of our income inequality in the country, but then there was nothing left, again, to be able to lobby the people in the legislature or even to run people to run for office. So I think you have to have organizational structure.
Thank you, Dolores. And I got to see your movie last year when you came to Sundance. On March 20th, for Salt Lake County is caucus night. And I'm the chair of the state Hispanic caucus for the Democratic Party. And so I would like to ask you to please join us. Would you please explain to the students how powerful it is for them to come to caucus night and become a delegate? And set up. So please do that. Thank you.
So how old do they have to be?
Voting age, which is 18.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is what we're talking about right here. I mean, and this is the one place where you can all join and to see.
18 by November.
Yeah, this is the way that you can see how this democracy works, because during the caucuses, I do believe that they vote for delegates or vote for people that are going to represent them. So please, everybody come to those. Did you say where it's going to be at? Did you give the location?
So you say in elementary school, your local school.
In the local, your local elementary school in your neighborhood, please come to the caucus. What time is it going to be?
Tuesday,
what time?
7. Are you okay?
Okay, Salt Lake County Caucus Night, right? You can Google it. So please come to the caucuses. That's the best way that you can see. Not that I agree with the caucus system, okay, but you do have it here in this state. So please come there, and then that you can actually cast your vote for the person that you want to represent you. And it's a good learning experience, so everybody needs to be there. Please come and bring somebody with you. Don't come by yourself, all right? Organize somebody to be there with you.
All right, we have one more question. Hi, Dolores. I am here with my fifth grade students today, and I want to know, what advice do you have for them as they grow up to be leaders of color in our community?
Well, the best thing for them and for everybody else in the room is to go out there and be involved, I want to say, especially to parents, take your kids with you, your nieces and your nephews, when you go on marches or picket lines. I like to quote my son, Ricky, who you will see in the film. And Ricky has this great, because the film makes a big issue about my leaving my children with different families, which, by the way, we need to have. One of the things that we need is to have early education, right, for all of our families, so that our kids are well taken care of and educated at the same time. It should be free for every family. But I used to have to leave my children with different families while I traveled. And my son Ricky has this great line. He says, yeah, my mother abandoned us. she abandoned us on the parking lot of a Safeway store, okay, with a bunch of leaflets that we had to pass out. And when they would say, boycott grapes. And then when they would come and they would say to us, why don't you go back to Mexico? He'd say, we can't, we don't have a ride, okay? But the thing is, if you take your kids with you to marches and to picket lines, then nobody has to tell them about movement and about standing up or about representing, because they are living it and they're learning it. And don't ask them, do you want to go to the march? Ask them, do you want to wear a blue shirt or a brown shirt, okay? Because otherwise they'll say no. So just take them with you. But that's the best way. Like, if kids can come, get involved, you know, go out there to a march. You know, if you don't do a march at your school, organize one. You can organize a little march for Cesar Chavez Day, you know, and just march around so kids can get that feeling of empowerment when they're all marching together and giving messages out, giving strong messages out. But the best way to do it, just participate. Just have kids participate. And that's the way that you grow your leadership.
That's longtime civil rights activist and American labor leader, Dolores Huerta. She spoke last week on March 14th at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your humble curator and newest producer of this program. Thank you for listening.